Old Testament prophecy of Isaiah. We have come this morning to begin our study of the 30th chapter. We will do so in three parts. We will think together concerning verses 1 to 17 that will speak to us concerning rebellion. The next section of verses will speak to us concerning restoration. And the final section of verses will deal with the retribution which God will visit upon his foes. But the first part we'll actually deal with in two parts, morning and evening today. This morning, looking at verses 1 to 7, and then this evening at verses 8 to 17, as we think about the rebellion of the people of God against him. Question: how many years' experience do you have? I was speaking to a man recently who said that he had 20 years of experience on his job. After he left our gathering, someone mentioned to me it might be more accurate to say that he has 1 year of experience repeated 20 times. So in your Christian experience, how experienced are you? 5 years? 10, 15, 20 longer? Or, if you're honest, do you find yourself repeating some of the same experiences over and over again? And do you find yourself covering some of the same ground today that you thought you had covered yesterday? It's like this. Some months ago now, as we were setting out to study the Old Testament prophecy of Isaiah, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah found themselves in quite a quandary. It seems that Israel, Ephraim, the northern kingdom, along with Syria, posed a great threat to them. And in their threat, and in their time of difficulty, rather than looking up to God, they found themselves looking inward at themselves and seeing how hopelessly inadequate they were for the challenge that was before them. And then very frantically and frenetically looking around to see who they might be able to find who could help them and assist them. And so for that threat that they were facing under King Ahaz, when Syria and Israel were waiting at the door, they turned to Assyria in hopes that Assyria would be their savior and that Assyria would come to their rescue and deliver them in the situation in which they found themselves. Interesting, though. Here we are, many years later, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah find themselves threatened once again. But this time, the threat is from the Assyrians. The threat this time is from the very ones to whom they had turned and the very ones in whom they had placed their trust in their previous time of difficulty. But had they learned? Had they benefited from their previous experience? Or did they go back and do very much the same thing that they had done previously? Unfortunately, that's the case. Because in this instance, they turned to the Egyptians. And they sought in the Egyptians to find their help in the time of difficulty and distress which they were facing at that particular time. So the sermon in summary is this, that despite the clear commands of God, which contain both the blessings of obedience as well as the consequences of disobedience, despite the clear commands of God, when faced with a threat at the hands of the Assyrians, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah placed their trust in the Egyptians rather than in God. Did you get that? Sometimes you have to summarize the summary. So let me give it to you and just break it down part by part. Though they had received the commands of God, which contained both the blessings of obedience as well as the consequences of disobedience, when they faced a threat at the hands of the Assyrians, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah placed their trust in the Egyptians rather than in God. I'm certainly glad we're not that way, are we? When we feel besieged, when we feel surrounded, when we feel threatened, when everything seems to be closing in on us, we would certainly never do anything like that, would we? We would certainly never look inward, become morbidly introspective, and think about how hopelessly inadequate we are for such challenges as these. That doesn't sound like us, does it? And we would certainly never look around frantically hoping that someone will come to our rescue, someone will come to our aid, someone will come to our defense. We've walked with Christ long enough that we know not to look in, not to look around, but always to look up. Or do we? Because we say to our own shame that just about the time that we think we're making a bit of progress spiritually, just about the time we think we're getting this Christian walk down, we have a test. We face a trial. We encounter a difficulty. And if we're honest, we sometimes respond not as we should, but we respond as we always have. And it actually serves to highlight for us the rebelliousness of our hearts toward God. We resist this notion of trusting Him and depending on Him. Now, here's what we're meant to do. He states it very plainly and clearly in verse 15. When he says, "For thus says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel." And now notice these words, "In returning and rest, you shall be saved. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength." What a remarkable statement. God is saying that when you return to me and when you find your rest in me, you will be delivered. This will be your salvation. And it's not actually in your frantic efforts to bring others to your aid. And it's actually not in this frenetic activity, you know, which sees you going from place to place, trying thing after thing. But actually it's in quietness and it's in confidence that you find your strength. That's what we're meant to do. That's how we're meant to be. But did you notice how Isaiah the prophet took this statement from God and then addressed it to the people to whom he is prophesying? Four words. "But you would not." You would not return to Him. You would not find your rest in Him. You would not be quiet. You would not let confidence in the Lord be your strength. You would not. Why? Because He said you had a better plan. You had something that you thought was a better idea. You said, no, we will flee on horses. Therefore you shall flee. So you understand what he's saying. He says, this is what you want to do. I'm going to allow you to do it. This is the direction you want to take. I'm going to allow you to take it. We will flee on horses. All right. You will flee on horses. And we will ride on swift horses. Okay. Therefore, those who pursue you shall be swift. You understand what God is trying to remind his people here? That he is actually sovereign even over their enemies. So you say, we will flee. He says, all right, I will give you a situation from which you have to flee. We will flee on swift horses. All right, I will cause those who pursue you to be swift. How much better it would have been for them simply to have returned to the Lord, for them to have found their rest in Him, for them to have been quiet, and for them to have been confident in the Lord. That would have been a position of strength. But actually, they would not. We will flee on horses. So they did flee. We will ride on swift horses. Therefore, those who pursued them would be swift as well. This is the rebelliousness of the people of Jerusalem and Judah. So let's think through the different parts of that summary I was giving you a moment ago. To begin with, there is the clear command from God. We've just been talking about it. Return to me. Find your rest in me. Be quiet. And this, of course, is not talking about not speaking. But he's talking about quietness of spirit. Don't be anxious and fretful and wrought up with concern. Be confident, not in yourself or in others, but be confident in me. This is the clear command of Scripture. Now, the blessings of obedience to this command are clear, because he says that if you do this, you shall be saved. And if you do this, you shall be strengthened. Those are the consequences of obedience. And so he makes those clear. But he also makes clear to them the consequences of disobedience. And the consequences of disobedience are set forth primarily in verses 1 to 7. I'll just highlight some of them. One of them is shame, verse 3. Therefore, the strength of Pharaoh shall be your shame. Another of these consequences of disobedience is humiliation. As you see this also in verse 3. And trust in the shadow of Egypt shall be your humiliation. You see also that he will speak of reproach, because he will say in verse 5, they were all ashamed of a people who could not benefit them, or be, help, or benefit, but rather a shame, as we saw previously in verse 3, and also a reproach, as we see now in verse 5. So I set before you two paths. One is the path of obedience to God's clear command. It results in salvation and strength. You will be saved. You will be strengthened. The other is the consequences of disobedience, and this will involve shame and humiliation and reproach. You say, well, what do I have to do? It's obvious which of those two I want. I want to be saved. I want to be strengthened. All right, you have to rest in me, and you have to trust me. Well, exactly how much shame would I have to face? Could you clarify how much humiliation would be involved? How much reproach are we talking about here? Because we suddenly want to reconsider. Because if we are resting in Him, this means that we're not able to frantically move around and occupy ourselves in such a way that we think we are in control. And we can't frenetically keep moving from place to place and thing to thing, thinking that somehow we're going to manage this. Now, he says that's going to result in shame and humiliation and reproach. But if you want to be saved, if you want to be strengthened, you've got to stop that and rest in me and trust in me. Even when you feel threatened, even when you feel surrounded, even when you feel as though everything is closing in and everything is working against you. So it's up to you. There's a command. And there are clear consequences associated with obeying it. And there are clear consequences associated with disobeying it. So rest at ease. We're not going to take a vote. I'm not going to poll or canvass the congregation to see which of these two you would choose. However, I do know, in the safe confines of this chapel on a wonderful, beautiful, glorious September morning, if I were to ask you, which do you want? Salvation and strength? Or would you prefer a bit of shame and humiliation and reproach? I think that salvation and strength is going to win, hands down. I think everyone would say, yeah, I think I'll go for that. That's what I want. Okay. So what happens then when you have made this choice? What happens when you've made this decision? What happens when you've said, I'm going to turn my direction and I'm going to move in the direction of salvation and strength, and I don't want the shame, the humiliation, the reproach. I'm going to rest in God and I'm going to trust Him. Now, those of you who have experience, not 1 year of experience repeated 20 times, but those of you who have 20 years experience, what's about to happen when you say, I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back. I have decided I'm going to rest in Him, I'm going to trust in Him, it doesn't matter what happens, I'm not going to take my eyes off Him, I'm going to trust Him, I'm going to depend on Him. Those of you who have 20 years experience, not 1 year repeated 20 times, those of you with 20 years experience, what's about to happen? You're going to have a test, aren't you? You're going to face a test. And that test is actually going to take the form of a threat. That threat is going to be something that's going to unsettle you. That threat is going to be something that's going to bring you face to face with your own inadequacy. That threat is going to be something that's going to cause you to see, I am now faced with a situation that is above and beyond my ability to manage and control. And so all of this nice talk about resting in the Lord and trusting in Him is all well and good until we actually have to rest in Him. Till we actually have to trust Him. And it's all well and good when we can remember back, you know, to that long distant time when, you know, Israel and Syria were coming against us, and we looked to Assyria and we say, oh, I'll never do that again. I've learned my lesson on that one. That's not going to happen. And then the same situation visits us again. And what do we do so often? We find ourselves reverting back to our old pattern. We find ourselves doing the same thing that we had always done. Now, I don't want to minimize what's happening here. You can go to the British Museum. And in the British Museum, they have this remarkable exhibition that talks about the campaign of Sennacherib, the Assyrian, against Judah. And you can see how there were 40,000 three primary towns in Judah at this particular time. And you can see how Sennacherib had systematically invaded and destroyed 41 of them and was on number 42. So now Jerusalem here is at number 43. And so you can understand why they are feeling a little bit, you know, under pressure. They're feeling a little bit, you know, apprehensive. They're feeling as though, you know, they're surrounded and everything is going against them. And what happens is in the heat of that moment, they revert back to what they had always done. Now, it's sort of like this. I don't think we have any Australians in the congregation this morning. If we do, my apologies up front. So 25 years ago, I go to Australia, and while I'm in Australia, I'm doing teaching, ministry in local churches, and after I've worked hard for a while, they decide to give me some time off for good behavior. So we're going to go to a park, we're going to have a picnic, and then we're going to play some sports. And so to play sports with the particular group that I was with meant that we were going to play Aussie Rules football. And so we play a little bit of Aussie Rules football. Now, they're intrigued by my accent. They knew that I wasn't from Australia. And they thought that perhaps I could teach them a little American rules football, or what they persisted in calling gridiron. And so I'm going to teach them a little American rules football. Now, the Aussies, you know, well, the ones that I was with at least were a little thick. And so it was not easy to teach them American rules football. And so though I was adopting my best teaching methods, I mean, I had a stick and I had sand and I was, you know, sort of showing them where everyone would be placed and I was showing them how the play should be executed. And you would think, you know, Barry actually knew what he was talking about because I'm laying this out, American rules. So then I would take these men, I would have to physically put them in their place and tell them, now, when the play begins, this is what you're meant to do. No, not all Aussies are thick, but these were. Because would you believe me that every single play began with American rules and ended in Aussie rules? Because what happened is at the moment that the play began, when flesh hit flesh, when the play was actually being executed, they went back to instinct and intuition, to what they had always done, to how they had always played the game before. And finally, we just had to give up in exasperation that these Aussies are not going to be able to play American rules football. They're never going to get gridiron, because though I can clearly tell them, this is the role that you play, this is how the play is executed, this is how you actually go about doing this, the instant that flesh hit flesh, intuition and instinct took over and they reverted back to the rules that they had known since they were little boys. I'm certainly glad we're not that way. I mean, the preacher can sometimes adopt his best teaching stance on the Lord's Day, and he can stand and say, all right, now, this is what you're meant to do, and this is your role, and this is the part that you have to play, and this is how this is going to play out, this is how it's going to go, and we're all just sort of like my Aussie students, you know, shaking their head, yeah, got that. But then what happens? Flesh hits flesh. The play begins. Life resumes. And if we're not careful, we go back to what we've always known and to what we've always done. And that's what was happening with these people. And it was actually the threat of Assyria that was a test from God. A test not because God didn't know where they stood, and God, you know, wanted to see how they would perform. No, the test was not for the benefit of the instructor. The test was for the benefit of the student to realize, I don't know quite as much as I thought. I've not advanced as much as I would like to believe. I've still got quite a ways to go. And so how did they respond to the test? Well, I stated a moment ago that they responded to this threat from Assyria, this test from God, by placing their trust in Egypt rather than in God. So what did that actually look like? Well, there's three statements in the opening verses of the chapter that let us know. First of all, they took counsel. They took counsel. That's a good thing, isn't it? In the multitude of counselors, there's safety. You want to talk to people, get their insights, benefit from their wisdom, seek counsel. Good thing, right? They took counsel, but not of me. So what do you do when you're in a situation like this, when you feel as though things are closing in, everything's against you? Oh, well, I have this Christian friend, or I have this person I've always had a lot of, you know, confidence in. I have this person I've often turned to in the past. I have someone who understands me, who gets me. All right, you take counsel, but do you take counsel from God? I've spoken to many people over the years that when they say, I'm in this situation, I don't know what to do, and I say, have you asked the Lord? And they look at me as though, well, I hadn't even thought of that. Have you asked the Lord? They take counsel, but not of me. Not only that, a second thing he says, they devise plans. Now that's good. That's very good. Have you got a plan? You got a plan. What are you going to do? What's your strategy? What's your plan? How are you going to approach this situation? You know, I don't have a plan. Okay, that's a bad thing. You know, you got to have a plan. You got to have a strategy. What are your action steps? What are you actually going to do? He said, well, you devise plans. But these plans are not of my spirit. And he says, and you walk to go down to Egypt. And he's going to expand on that in verses 6 and 7. He's actually here talking about the great efforts they will go, the extents to which they will go, the extremes to which they will go to find help and assistance. He says, you're willing to walk down to Egypt. Reversing your steps, by the way, because you've come out of Egypt by way of the Exodus, and now you're walking back to Egypt. And he says, but you have not asked my advice. You see how horribly they are failing the test. That he says, you're taking counsel, but you're not taking it from me. You're devising plans, but they're not plans of my spirit. You're putting forth a lot of effort and energy to walk back to Egypt, and you're going to strengthen yourself in the strength of Pharaoh, and you're going to trust in the shadow of Egypt, but you've not even asked for my advice. And so trust means that we take counsel from the Lord. Trust means that the plans that we make are the plans that are ordered by His Spirit. Trust means that we ask His advice. We find out from Him what He would have us to do. And you say, if we don't do that, is that a bad thing? Well, you tell me. Verse 1 says that when you take counsel but not of God, and when you devise plans that are not of the Spirit, you add sin to sin. You know, Assyria was being raised up against them to discipline them, to chastise them because of their sin. Right? But he says, now when you turn to the Egyptians to rescue you from the Assyrians, you're compounding the matter and you're adding sin to sin. He says, therefore, the strength of Pharaoh will be your shame, and trust in the shadow of Egypt will be your humiliation. His princes were at Zoan. That's the place where the magicians met with Moses and saw the signs and wonders before the release of the Israelites from Egyptian captivity. And his ambassadors came to hands. But they were all ashamed of a people. They could not benefit them. They could not be of help or benefit, but only shame and a reproach. The extremes to which we will go, listen, this burden, it's an oracle, if you will. The burden against the beast of the south. Through a land of trouble and anguish, from which came the lioness and lion, the viper and fiery flying serpent, they will carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys and their treasures on the humps of camels to a people who shall not profit. Wouldn't it have been easier just to seek counsel from God? Wouldn't it have been easier just to follow the plans laid out in His Word by the Holy Spirit? Wouldn't it have been better just to turn to Him for advice? These people are going through a land of trouble and anguish. They are going through a land that is occupied by lions and lionesses. They're going through a land where there are vipers and fiery flying serpents. The extent that we will go and the extremes to which we will go to keep from resting in the Lord and trusting in Him. It's pointless. Why do we do it? And it's costly. They carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys, their treasures on the humps of camels, and they are taking all of their profit and are giving their profit to a people who shall not profit. They'll not benefit them at all. What are you going to gain from this? What are you going to benefit from this? He says, the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore, I have called her Rahab, him Shabbat. Now, Rahab was often a name given for Egypt, and here he is saying that Rahab is idle, shall not profit or benefit in any way. So see if we can remember that summary and then draw it to a close. Despite having received the commandments of God, containing clear rewards and blessings for obedience, you'll be saved, you'll be strengthened, and having been informed beforehand of the clear consequences of disobedience, shame, humiliation, and reproach. When faced with test from God and threat from the Assyrians, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah place their trust in the Egyptians rather than in God. And my question is, what will you do? What will I do? The next time our back's against the wall, the next time we don't know what to do, the next time we feel surrounded, the next time we feel as though everything is closing in on us, what will we do? He says, return to me. Find your rest in me. And you will be saved. He says, be quiet. He's not saying don't talk. He's saying be quiet in your spirit. And confidence in me will be your strength. When faced with that command, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and Judah said no. No. We will flee. All right, you'll have to flee. We'll flee on swift horses. All right, those who pursue you will be swift as well. He says 1,000 shall flee at the threat of one, and at the threat of five, a whole nation shall flee. So what will you do? It's easy this morning, 11:30, sitting comfortably in a Baptist chapel in the heart of Dunstable, to say, I'll rest in the Lord. I'll trust in Him. He's in control. He's in charge. He's got this. But when you visit the GP and the results are not what you hoped for, when you sit down with that family member from whom you have been long estranged and you come to realize the way of reconciliation is not going to be quite as easy as you thought, when the redundancy notice comes through, when the bankruptcy proceedings began, when the person near and dear to you dies, what will you do? I pray that by God's grace, you will rest in Him, and that by His power, you will trust in Him. In so doing, you will be saved and strengthened. But if you do what we have all so often done before, take matters into our own hands and dwell on them in our own hearts and try to sort them all out in our own heads, it'll ultimately end in shame, humiliation, and reproach. Rest God. Trust in God. You will be saved. You will be strengthened.